Greetings and salutations. Ladies and gentlemen, we are living in tomorrow's history, Hawk Watchers. Every day, week, and month that passes is another chapter written in tomorrow's future history books. Many years from now, when the historians of the 22nd century look back on the state of the world today to better inform their decisions, it's important that our future historians, those future generations, our children's children, their children, get the most accurate representation of today's current political situations than the lie agreed upon version that many of our politicians, leaders, talking heads, and governments prefer. Who will write today's future history? Will it be those who tell us that our ships were fired on in the Gulf of Tonkin, that there were WMDs in Iraq, that the U.S. President Donald Trump is Putin's puppet, and that the only purpose for the more than 800 military bases in more than 70 countries around the globe is to bring pure, unadulterated freedom and apple pie to the rest of the world? Or will it be the journalists who didn't go along to get along, the journalists and researchers who chose the road adorned with ridicule and scorn and having to fight for every inch in order to write the reality of the day as they see it, the ones who hold the powerful accountable and ultimately help us to be better equipped to find the truth? It's the kind of journalism that isn't afraid to dig into the blanket of secrecy and disbelief that shrouds the United States national security state and its relationship to the rise of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and even U.S. President Donald Trump, which journalist and author Max Blumenthal dives into in his latest book, The Management of Savagery. So let's take a dive into that savagery of the neoliberal con empire, and with Max Blumenthal, as we hope to add a little more truth about today into tomorrow's history books. We do that by watching the Hawks.
If you want to know what's going on in your city, in your streets, never back down like Tyrell, and the truth is what you seek. To analyze, investigate from the bottom to the top. You speak your mind like Sean Stone, whether they like it or not. I got Tabitha, Miss Wallace, with the wisdom and the pearl. Between the outrage and the evidence, what's going on in this world?
Watching the Hawks. Watching the Hawks. Watching the Hawks. Listen when they talk.
Welcome, everyone, to Watching the Hawks. I am Tyrell Ventura.
And I'm Tabitha Wallace. And joining us now to discuss the management of savagery is journalist and author Max Blumenthal. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Max, great, fascinating book. Definitely people got to check this out. And I want to start and ask you, look, this book covers a lot of, I think, many mainstream media people would say, controversial ground as you lay out, U.S. foreign policy bare. What was your inspiration to write this book? Was there an event or sequence of events that took place, in the last few years or whoever that like kind of drove you to say, I have to get this down on paper, I have to make sure that people know, your version, the real version of what's going on today?
Yeah, I think the inspiration was just the journalism that we were doing at thegrayzone.com over the past few years and kind of putting the pieces together, looking back at where I had gotten the Arab Spring wrong and seeing the Syrian proxy war for what it was, and then going back into the history of these proxy wars, back to Afghanistan in 1979 when the U.S., Zbigniew Brzezinski, the head of Carter's NSC, made the fateful decision to arm the Mujahideen, and thus the consequences that's had for the West. I mean, you have a graphic behind you of bin Laden sitting next to Trump. Bin Laden was effectively a CIA asset helping to fund the Services Bureau, which sent fighters and money through Pakistan into Afghanistan, laid the basis for the creation of Al-Qaeda. And as I explain in my book, the 9/11 attacks have reshaped our political culture completely, and Donald Trump was very close to the ground in New York and absorbed the anti-Muslim atmosphere and exploited it to great effect to become president. And it's a factor that's unacknowledged in Trump's rise, as well as the rise of so many far-right elements. That wouldn't have happened. I really don't believe 9/11 would have happened if it weren't for the Afghan proxy war. And I don't believe that the war in Iraq would have happened if it weren't for 9/11. And I don't believe that the rise of ISIS would have taken place without the war in Iraq. So we have to put the pieces together and put all of this into context. And that's what I tried to do with this book that begins 2 years after I was born in 1977.
Wow.
I think, we're all of that generation. This is the story, kind of the political story of our lives and the atmosphere that we've lived in.
I think that's the really interesting thing about this is you say that because I was born in 77 and I feel like we've always had these Middle East wars and terrorists or Muslims and we've always sort of been fed that, whether, whatever it was, whether we were in you know, Desert Storm or whatever they wanted to call it, it was theater.
Right.
And it was theater to make us think a certain way, not really about keeping anybody safe. And that's why I wonder, when you look at this string of foreign policy maneuvers, these strategies that have happened, the United States and, like you said, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Ukraine, and now Venezuela, do you see a common thread through all of them? Or is it just sort of that it's like catch as catch can, and this is just keeps happening because they just don't bother to fix their mistakes?
Yeah, there are several common threads. I mean, one is just the U.S. hunger for regime change to extend the arm of, you know, U.S.-linked capital and to basically maintain a constantly growing empire. The other threat is the need to convince an American public which is skeptical of these wars with humanitarian interventionist propaganda. Well, whether it's Niara, who happened to be the niece of the Kuwaiti ambassador who falsely testified
That's
that
right.
Saddam Hussein's army were taking babies off of their incubators in Kuwait, mm-hmm. which I write about in my book, or it was the White Helmets in Syria, a U.S. and U.K. influence operation established by a former British military intelligence officer named James Le Mercurier, who has actually been lobbying the bookstore in D.C., Politics and Prose, to postpone my book launch. And he had some success there. It's pretty remarkable and understandable why he wouldn't want this book to be out there, because it exposes his cynical tactics. So that's always been a constant. But the other thing that's been a constant is a lack of concern about blowback, whether it's blowback in terms of, you know, when you arm and equip Salafi jihadi extremists, that comes back home, or destabilizing entire societies and regions, which leads to refugee crises. And today we see that this Libyan civil war is still continuing 8 years later.
Yeah. It's going to get way worse, too.
And it's going to get worse. It's caused a refugee crisis that Muammar Gaddafi personally warned Tony Blair about. Mm-hmm. Blair discarded it and said, you have to leave. And the rest is history. The blowback arrived in the form of a refugee crisis that has reshaped European politics, and Libya is still in a state of catastrophe.
Yeah, it truly is. When you see like all of this, and then when they try to sell you on the next one down the line, when the Venezuela,
the new one will work,
Iran, you know, all of that. What's interesting is, as you said, you laid out, you know, you kind of started this, and it's really the bulk of our lives when you know, kind of looking at this map that you laid out. In writing and researching the book, was there any part of U.S. policy or manipulation that you weren't aware of going in that then shocked even Max Blumenthal?
Yes, great question. I mean, one of the most shocking things to me was when I started looking at the 1990s and the period leading up to 9/11, I learned that there actually was an actual Al-Qaeda cell in New York that was operating directly under the watch of the CIA and the FBI.
When was this?
Throughout the 1990s.
Wow.
It was a direct result of the Afghan war. Mm. It was called the Al-Kifa Center, and it was partly located in Jersey City near where I used to live, and also in downtown New York. And the CIA had used it during the Afghan war in the 80s to send men to the battlefield, and then they used it in the 90s to send men to Bosnia, like Rodney Hampton L. in Chechnya. And at the same time, this group was training at a gun range, being trained by someone named Ali Abdel Soud Mohammed, who was personally recruited by the Eminence Greece of Al-Qaeda, of bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, to be his agent in the U.S. while he was simultaneously working for the FBI and CIA. And this has all been documented by another journalist named Peter Lance. It's not some bizarre conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And this group was eventually indicted for the bridge and tunnel plot, one of the first major terror trials. Mm-hmm. And it was a manufactured case using a confidential informant who was a liar. A lot of these guys were just mentally disturbed figures, but they were operating all that time under the watch of the CIA. And I interviewed the lawyer who defended, one of the lawyers who defended them, and he told me that when he tried to bring Ali Abdel Soud Mohammed, the triple agent, onto the stand, the prosecutors, led by Patrick Fitzgerald, ordered Ali Mohammed to hide and not appear because the government was so embarrassed about what it had done. So I was so shocked to learn this history.
Yeah.
And of course, who is the biggest figure on trial there that we learned about? The blind sheikh.
Before bin Laden, there was the blind sheikh.
I learned that he entered the U.S. on a CIA visa.
Amazing.
Now, all that and more, you've got to check this out. Management of Savagery. I wish we could have, I'd talk to you for hours, Max. Thank you so much for
the great work you're doing.
And definitely everyone check out the book.
Despite the very foundations of the United States of America being built upon the freedom of the press, that hasn't stopped the U.S. government from attacking, persecuting, and many feel potentially prosecuting WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And now, with WikiLeaks announcing that they have confirmation that any day or even any minute the Ecuadorian embassy in London is going to expel Assange from the safety of their walls, many are now wondering what the future will hold for the man who has embodied the spirit of freedom of the press. RT America's Michelle Greenstein has more.
WikiLeaks announced late last night that a high-level source from the Ecuadorian government told them that Assange will be expelled within hours or days and that Ecuador already has an agreement with the UK to do so. Hours later, it claimed it had secondary confirmation. Then, this morning, it tweeted that it had obtained the press strategy for expelling him. On the other hand, a senior Ecuadorian official told AP that no decision has been made to expel Assange, and the UN Special Rapporteur on Privacy also announced today that it had confirmation from the Ecuadorian government that Assange would still be in the embassy 20 days from now. Still, Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno has discussed offering up Assange in exchange for debt relief from the U.S. in the past. Also of significance is that Moreno is scheduled to be here in D.C. later this month. Assange has been in this embassy since 2012 after seeking refuge from extradition to Sweden over sexual assault allegations, all of which were later dropped. When he does leave the embassy, he'll be arrested and likely extradited to the U.S. for publishing classified military and diplomatic cables through WikiLeaks. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel Forms of Punishment, Niels Melzer, commented today that he's alarmed by reports that Assange may be kicked out, urged the government of Ecuador to abstain from expelling him, and noted that he intended to personally investigate the case. Earlier today, London police said in a statement that there's an active warrant for Assange's arrest and that they're obliged to execute that warrant should he leave the embassy. Now, for Ecuador to force Assange out of the embassy would be a violation of international law on refugees, but Ecuador's foreign minister tweeted just hours ago that diplomatic asylum is a sovereign faculty of the state and that a state has the right to grant it or withdraw it unilaterally whenever it considers it to be justified. Many say that if asylum is withdrawn and Assange is extradited to the U.S., it will not only be a tragedy for this man's health and human rights, it will also be a serious loss for the American public and their right to know what their government, their so-called representatives, are doing. For Watching the Hawks, Michelle Greenstein, RT.
As we go to break, Hawk Watchers, don't forget to let us know what you think of the topics we've covered on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, and see our full shows at RT.com. Coming up, conservative commentator Steve Malzberg joins us for a little debate over the Violence Against Women Act currently being voted on by the U.S. Congress, and then we preview the latest episode of Redacted Tonight. Stay tuned to Watching the Hawks.
Dear viewer, thank you for finally changing the channel. I understand you're tired of networks that blur news with views. You're tired of commentary presented as fact and facts presented as commentary. They are not the same, no matter what the partisan hack want you to think. You know me. I'm famous for my views, and you'll get them. And the news. And me. Yours truly, Scotty Nell Hughes.
Do you know what you've got in your hand? You might think it's a phone, but in the news, we see it as TV. With Pluto TV, the free and unlimited TV app, you can get TV everywhere for free. And since TV is everywhere, so is RT. Streaming on all your favorite devices, outdoors or inside, any time of day or night. Catch all of our award-winning shows, news, and cutting-edge analysis everywhere you look and wherever you go. Question more.
You know how the mainstream media debates the same point ad nauseum every day when you just want the dialogue without the nonsense? Well, come here to Watching the Hawks, where what it takes the mainstream media 8 hours a day to debate, we give you in just 5 minutes. This week, the NRA lobbied heavily against the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act due to the fact that it restricts gun sales to those convicted of domestic violence or stalking. Here's Democratic Representative Gwen Moore to explain.
Well, I say that if you are against taking guns away from perpetrators, if you are for stripping the provisions that protect the most vulnerable women within our communities, then you have joined that group of people who want to silence the voice of victims. Silence the voice that says we're not gonna be victims, we're gonna be victors. Let's move on. Thank you.
But that wasn't the hill Republicans chose to defend. Joining us now from New York to give the conservative side is conservative commentator Steve Malzberg. Steve.
Okay, well, you know, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, there's a reason that the Democrats let this expire and left it out of the February budget agreement, which kept the government open. Their plan is to insert these add-ons into the act, which would not have been greeted all that warmly. First, the bill, which passed the House, expands gun restrictions, as you said, beyond those convicted of a felony, and expands it to convictions for misdemeanor abuse or stalking, which could include, for abuse, constant criticism, name-calling, for stalking, sending gifts and making calls. It seems a bit harsh to lose your Second Amendment rights for those violations. Second, the bill passed forces all shelters and prisons to house inmates according to their gender identity and not their biological sex. Now, this is supposed to protect transgender women. But as Congresswoman Debbie Kesko, herself a domestic abuse survivor, pointed out, she said it's not fair that the government is forcing circumstances that facilitate biological males from sleeping right next to biological women, that lets them sleep right next to a biological woman in prisons and especially in abuse shelters. It's not fair to the women, she said. Now, the good news, it looks like both the Senate and the White House want a clean extension of the Violence Against Women Act, minus these ridiculous additions that we're talking about. And I think that's what's going to have to happen if this is going to get passed and reinstated again.
Steve, thank you for that first half of that debate. Tabitha Wallace, you are up next. Take it away.
Well, I would say this. I mean, once, you know, Steve, since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, which is that in name, but doesn't actually specifically say that it's only for women. But since then, and since the things that were put in 1993, you've had the rates of violence against males has declined 54%. Since then, that's from 1.8 per 1,000 age 12 years and older to 0.8%. Between 1993 and 2007, the number of intimate partner homicides of men decreased 36%. And the truth is, this story about trans women and biological men, the only trans person who has ever been found guilty or ever been arrested of abusing a child in a bathroom was a woman named Michelle Martinez. Number one, she wasn't a stranger in a public restroom. She was a family friend who originally raped the girl in the 10-year-old victim in a bathroom in the victim's home. So nothing with this bill would have protected this child. However, if we treated sexual assault and domestic violence seriously, instead of deciding whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor, we seriously, instead of using it as a battering ram for politicking, maybe we'd all just be a little bit safer.
That's a very good point. All right. You know, look, here's my take on this whole issue. I think that the ultimate important thing that has to happen is the protection of all of us, women, men, and whatever anyone wants to claim to be. So in my mind, it's like, look, if we want to take away somebody's gun rights because they're more liable to use a gun in that situation and they have a legitimate history of violence, that is fine with me. I'm okay with that because that's someone who's been convicted with a legitimate history of violence. And when I look at the transgender issues and things like that being brought up, at the end of the day, this is kind of apples and oranges because I'm not aware of any instance where you see a transgender woman or, you know, man who is now a woman or something of that nature attacking and assaulting a woman based on gender and not based on, like, personal beef or, like, the reasons that people attack each other. You know, so I really think it's kind of making a mountain out of a molehill just to kind of get political points. However, as you said, Steve, this is something that probably they're going to strip down and they're going to get passed anyway. I think any move forward and at least getting the violence against women down is a good move forward. It's all baby steps from here. Thank you so much, Steve, for coming on and for that great debate.
Look at that.
Always a pleasure. Look at that. 5 minutes. We did it all.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Steve. Right,
thank you. Water, water everywhere, but not a spring to drink from, at least for Nestle's Poland spring water, which is neither Polish nor from a spring. In a new class action lawsuit, it seems that people don't actually like paying for spring water that isn't, well, you know, spring water. And on this week's new episode of RT America's Redacted Tonight, the team took aim at big water, big charity, and big hate. And here to preview the brand new episode is senior Redacted Tonight preview correspondent, Natalie McGill.
Can I elect to have that as my lower third from now on?
Yes. Yeah.
Senior preview corresponding. Or is here, let us know.
Natalie, what is going on with Poland Spring? What is happening?
Yeah, so as you said, so there are Americans from several states that filed a class action suit against Nestle, alleging that it's Poland Spring water, which they say is 100% natural spring water, is actually common groundwater. And on top of that, they say that the original Poland Spring in Maine, which Nestle claims this water is from, actually dried up 50 years ago. And on top of that, the suit alleges that Nestle, the wells that Nestle uses to extract water, the multiple wells, they are near a present or former human waste dump, landfill, or other similar site. So trash water, essentially. And Nestle's clearly profiting off of this deception. The Poland Spring brand has raked in profits between $300 million and $900 million in the past decade. 13 million people drink this water. And obviously, Nestle's been in the news lately for not so great things, mainly extracting all of the fresh water from states like California and Michigan for essentially what to them would be pennies, just hundreds of dollars. Yeah. And I have a clip. Naomi did an awesome job presenting this.
Let's take a look.
Check it out.
Nestle, the largest food company in the world, is under fire for a brand of water it owns. It turns out Poland Spring is not from natural springs, nor from any springs, nor from the Poland Spring of Maine, nor from Poland. That would be you know what? It would probably be more offensive if I attempted to pronounce it. Not one drop of Poland Spring water actually qualifies as spring water, a class action lawsuit says. This news was more shocking to me than when I found out that Gerber baby food was not in fact made by this baby. That's why I stopped eating it at the age of 13. Not because I could chew. Chewing is for street people. Poland Spring speaks for herself in this ad.
I don't come from a tap. I come from springs. I am born natural. I am Poland Spring, 100% natural spring water.
On the one hand, that is authentic, because if water could talk, she would obviously sound like a phone sex operator gasping for air. But in the words of the plaintiffs, she's actually a colossal fraud perpetrated against American consumers. 100% fraud.
I mean, if you're allowed to sell dirty water at a premium, how come the people of Flint can't sell their tap water for a profit and then fix their pipes?
Exactly.
I mean, it was as good as Poland Spring.
The other thing that really gets me is, like, when you mention that thing too, you know, is that Nestle goes all around the country and all around the world just sucking water out from all
stealing municipal water supplies
nothing,
over and over.
Yes. Nothing. They don't got to pay for anything. It's like all profit at the end of the day for them, and then, you know, no rivers and lakes and streams for us.
Or clean water that we can drink.
Right, because why would we put money into actually having clean water that comes out of our tap when we could, you know, make plastic bottles and have to do that and then clean up the plastic later? And I think those are job creators.
Out of the hose at one point. Anyway.
On the upside, Naomi definitely has a future in voiceover work for Nestle.
Yes.
She nailed that lady.
Redacted. If the bottom drops out on Redacted, she's
you're
got
good.
A Nestle
like,
voiceover.
Like, I'm fine with you guys now.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit. So you found that big charity is supposed to do like big good. When you have hundreds of billions of dollars, you're supposed to be like, yes, we're going to make big changes. But you found one charity that's kind of a big bummer.
Yeah, especially given what's part of their name. So it's the National Christian Foundation.
No.
And it's the eighth largest public charity in the nation. And it's under some heat right now because there was an investigation by Sludge that found they've donated $56 million over the past 3 years to anti-LGBT, anti-Muslim, and anti-immigrant hate groups, one of those being the David Horowitz Freedom Center, whose founder, David Horowitz, called Muslims Islamic Nazis and says all Muslim associations are fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood, which obviously really undermines the work of Islamic charities and Muslim NGOs that constantly live in fear that they're going to be tied to terroristic organizations. And it's already been proven that his words have actions because his work, Spencer's work, has been cited 64 times in the manifesto of a man who went on a killing spree in Norway 8 years ago. And on top of this, the NCF is what's called a donor-advised fund. So people can create an account with the NCF and they can ask them to donate their money to any organization of their choosing, and they can do it anonymously. Mm. So not even, you and I don't know who they're donating to. The IRS doesn't even know who they're donating to. Yeah, it's completely, completely anonymous.
That sounds very frightening to me.
Yeah, I thought, I feel like Jesus wouldn't like that. I feel like that charity is pretty much something Jesus wouldn't do.
Yeah.
I only have 8 years of religious school training, though, on that.
Can we just toss that charity to the lions?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Don't miss Redacted Tonight, which airs Friday on RT America. And be sure to check out Redacted Tonight VIP, which includes exclusive interviews and guests. Now, Miguel, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you
for
coming on and being the senior Redacted Tonight preview correspondent. It's always a pleasure.
Been a good week here. We got lots going on.
That has. Good day. All right, everybody.
Thank you.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for you today. Remember, everyone in this world, we are not told that we are loved enough, so I tell you all, I love you. I am Tyrell Ventura.
I'm Tabitha Wallace.
Keep on watching all those hawks out there, and have a great day and night, everybody.